This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I want to thank everyone for all of the emails I've been getting to celebrate the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper. It's been very kind of you to send all of these emails, and I'm just want to thank you right at the beginning. And now I want to welcome a very special guest, Thomas Tarantino. And the name of his book is Looking for Legends. Let us take you somewhere you've never been before and introduce you to our friends. Hi, Thomas, are you there?
Yes, I am, Patsy, and thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Well, I am. This is a marvelous book. This is like a dream book. It's just so fantastic. Now, are you on your own today, or do you have somebody with you? Is Barbara with you?
I'm on my own today. This is a book co-authored by my wife, Barbara Scott, and myself. But as I tell people when they ask, she's the inspiration, and I'm the perspiration.
Well, and she is quite a remarkable person. I'm telling you, what you two have done here is so fantastic. It is so many people. You know, I start this program that this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And then there are, you know, so many people dream of doing things, and you've done it. You've done
it all.
Well,
but I'll tell you, it all starts with dreams. And one of the questions we ask everybody in the book is, which would you rather have, dreams or memories?
You're right.
How about you, Patsy?
Oh, me. Well, I started dreaming when I was very young. At 11 years old, I started dreaming that I was going to move to England. And everybody, yeah, I'm from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and everybody thought I was nuts. But by the time I was 21, I had saved, at that time, $25,000, and I bought a house, a little cottage, a 400-year-old cottage, actually, in England. So I'm a big dreamer, and I've made a lot of my dreams come true. I've traveled a lot, but not as much as you. You've done how many countries?
We've done over 50 countries, but it's not a question of how many. It's a question of
quality.
Which ones, and, you know, did you do it for a purpose? And I must confess that when we started out, all we were doing is looking to escape, to get away from where we were, as far away as possible, as far out of the way as possible. And what happened was, we kept finding people in these places that represented the spirit of the place and who should be worldwide household names. But outside of the location, they'd either been forgotten or never known.
This is what is so wonderful about this book. For me, of course, quite a few places are things that I've done myself. I particularly remember Zorba the Greek. That movie,
yep.
I love that movie so much. I still remember, because it was a forbidden movie. I wasn't supposed to go to that movie. And my big sister took me. And I was very young. And I wasn't, it wasn't a movie I shouldn't have gone. But that movie stayed in my mind. And I had to go to Greece. I had to feel that excitement of it. So I eventually did. So everything in this, and of course you touch it among many of your trips are things that affect readers, like Neruda. I had a whole years of passion for Neruda. So,
well, but let me first respond to you about Zorba the Greek. We went to the very beach where he had danced at the end of the movie.
I know you did.
And we went there because of him, and we went there because of his craziness, and it was perfect. Got the classic photo of Barbara dancing, and then when it comes to Pablo Neruda, that was another beach, and we went in, and the water was so unbelievably cold, but that was because of the Humboldt Current that comes up from Antarctica. And we've been to Lhasa, where Heinrich Herrer fled a prisoner of war camp, tutored the Dalai Lama. We went to Vilnius, South Tyrol. In Italy, it's a place that, well, it's in Europe, it must not be that interesting, but South Tyrol used to be part of Austria, and everybody who lives there still speaks German. And if you look at a map, and we have lots of maps in our book because we love maps and we think they bring the places alive, you'll see that every town, every city has two names, one in German, one in Italian, and the person who grew up there was a fellow by the name of Reinhold Messner. Have you ever heard of him?
No. Well, now, in your book, so tell people.
Of course. Well, Reinhold grew up to be a mountain climber, and he grew up to be the best mountain climber in history. He was the first person to climb the 14 tallest mountains in the world. He was and to climb the tallest mountain on each of the seven continents. Now, why don't we know of him? Because, relatively speaking, there are no mountains in the United States. And if you go to the West Coast, or perhaps Colorado, there'll be a mountain culture, but not for the rest of us. But this was somebody that's too good to miss. In your neck of the woods, we went to the Ghost Ranch. Are you familiar with that?
I haven't been there.
All right. Well, the Ghost Ranch is in New Mexico. It's right outside of Santa Fe. And it's larger than the island of Manhattan. And it's been a dude ranch. This is where George O'Keefe was. This is where the physicists who invented the atomic bomb had their weekends. This is where paleontologists discovered one of the greatest finds of dinosaurs in history. And today, it's owned by the Presbyterians who use it for weekend retreats. Zermatt, Switzerland. I'd never heard of Zermatt. You know, we're not fancy people who go on, you know, far-flung skiing vacations. But we looked it up, and that's where the Matterhorn is. And when we went there, we found the story of the first two people to climb the Matterhorn and the tragedy where a rope broke. We've been to Wadi Rum, which is where Lawrence of Arabia fought during the World War II. We've been to Luxor, and we didn't know who was the person to translate the hieroglyphs, but we certainly stumbled onto him. Another one of our favorite stories is we went to El Chaitán, Patagonia. Now, Patagonia is at the bottom of Argentina, at the bottom of the world, or if you will, El Fin del Mundo. We found two guys. They were from California. In the late 1960s, They got into a van, drove 16,000 miles down to El Chitón, climbed a mountain called Mount Fitzroy, and they were only the third people to do it. And on the way back, had a very interesting conversation. The first guy said, you know, I like this outdoor life, and I think I'm going to create a clothing company, and I'm going to name it after where we just were. Patagonia.
That's it. It's
The second guy says, well, you know, I like this lifestyle too, and I've already created a clothing company that I named after the hardest side of a mountain to climb. North Face. So there you have it. From little acorns, mighty oak trees grow.
You travels are so exciting. And of course, I mentioned Neruda, but you also, you were in Argentina. And tell us about Ricardo Giraldes. I never knew how to pronounce his name.
Giraldes? Ricardo Giraldes. Yeah. Well, he's actually probably one of the most arcane, but fabulously so. If you closed your eyes and had to think of two words that remind you of Argentina, what two words would you come up with?
I don't know. What are...
Gaucho?
Oh, well, of course, Gaucho. Yeah.
And tango.
Was.
And tango. Ricardo Giraldes wrote a book, Don Segundo Sombra, in which a boy who thought he was an orphan was taught to be a man by a gaucho. Except that this gaucho was the person who actually taught Ricardo Giraldes as a kid. And the book, Don Segundo Sombra, was Argentina's Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. The classic grade school coming-of-age story that's required reading. But Ricardo Giraldes did something else. He was a great dancer. And the tango was invented in the south side of Buenos Aires. It was a dance that men did with each other as they were waiting their turn in the brothels. It was said that no respectable woman would ever dance the tango, and all the disrespectable women were busy. In any case, the meat business made Argentines tremendously rich. Actually, it was refrigeration which made them tremendously rich, because they could ship meat from Argentina, where it cost nothing, to Europe, where it was worth a lot. And so the sons of the estancieros began going to Paris for their grand tours, but also to represent the meatpacking businesses. And one night, Ricardo Giraldes was asked at a fancy salon to do something that best represented his country. He grabbed a woman, and he danced a complete tango with her. And the tango took off, was tremendously popular. There were tango balls, tango teas, tango lunches. And in time, this exotic dance from Paris went back to Buenos Aires, and all the women who had refused to dance it because it was a disreputable dance in Buenos Aires, now loved it because it was an import from Paris. So here is someone, he dreamed of being a gaucho and was a tango dancer, and you can't speak of Argentina without speaking of him.
This is what is so wonderful about this book. Okay, at one point, you took your first trip together. Where was the very first one?
Oh, our first trip, like probably everybody, was to England, and then to France, and then to Germany, and we would try to travel with a group because we knew safety was in numbers, and we were a little reticent, a little shy, a little nervous, a little afraid.
This was back but, in what year did you start this?
In the 1990s.
Okay.
And we got our feet wet. We got a little bit more comfortable. We realized that we didn't have to know the languages of all the various places. As long as we paid attention and were respectful and were willing to make jokes about whatever problems we encountered. And, of course, it helped that we would be big tippers. But we became braver and braver. And then we tried the next step, and then the next step, and then the next step. And, one of the things we learned was how small the world really is. For example, we could leave Philadelphia on afternoon flight, fly down to Miami, get an overnight flight to Buenos Aires, switch to the domestic airport, take a flight down to El Calafate, get a car, and drive up to El Chitón and be there in time for dinner the next night. We could take a flight to Paris, with a connection to Athens, with a connection to Rhodes, which is an island in the middle of the Mediterranean, and we could be there the next day also for dinner. So there are so many places in the world that you can get to within 24 hours that just use your imagination. And we live in the East Coast of Philadelphia, where lots and lots of people will go to, quote-unquote, the Jersey Shore for 2 weeks during the summer. And if they rent a house for the 2 weeks, it's going to cost them $10,000. For that same $10,000, they could fly to Amsterdam and then down to Nairobi and go on a safari in the Masai Mara in Kenya. So travel isn't some tremendously expensive thing. It's really more a question of your imagination. And we may have gone to all these out-of-the-way places, but they're not as much out of the way as you might think they are. And we're not mountain climbers. We're not trekkers. We're not even hikers. We're more lookers. And what we found, and again, I go back to our initial question, which would you rather have, dreams or memories? We found that we get more enjoyment planning a trip than we do going on the trip. Because we can plan the trip and dream of the trip for 6 months. We can do all our research. We can create our itinerary. And no matter how great the trip is, it's 10 days or 2 weeks. So travel itself is a dream.
It's so wonderful, and for so many reasons. As you said, the planning, it keeps you busy. It keeps you involved, doing the research. Just that part is so much fun. Then, of course, you've added doing maps, and I love maps. I have an entire trunk of maps that I've collected over the years, traveling all over the world. And I just love maps. I started off really as a child drawing maps. My father's favorite subject when he was in school was geography. So we did maps from the time we were very young. Of course, we were always drawing treasure maps. But, you know.
And what's wrong with that?
Exactly. Nothing. And we did those, you know, for fun. And then we learned how to draw the countries. And it's. And you do a wonderful job. I don't know which one of you are, you know, love doing the drawings.
Well, neither of us. We were very lucky. We found a cartographer named Erin Greb, and she did all the maps. Uh-huh. And she's an incredible one. We probably have about, I'm going to guess, 50 maps in the book. And we love the maps, too, because they tell you the story without telling you the story. And we've got about 150 photos in the book because, not that we took any of them, but we found them. There are various stock houses on the Internet, Alame, Getty Images, Shutterstock. And we went on them, and we put in the name of the area, put in the particular site, and we found all these photos on the Internet. So, again, I guess we're getting a little bit toward the end. So, to my question, which would you rather have, dreams or memories? For us, it's dreams. Memories are what you have at the end of the day. Dreams are what get you up in the morning. And if you don't have dreams anymore, why are you living? So, again, it's all about your imagination. You don't have to go to the same old place you always went to before. If you can dream it, you can do it.
And if you have a particular interest in just a subject, and it sort of, I want to know something about it, people shouldn't be afraid of traveling to these places, because I have discovered wherever I've traveled, and I've been to, you know, places in the desert, I've been to all sorts of little villages and to places where there's almost no people, but you always find somebody there, somebody who's, well, you find storytellers that you meet along the way who want to tell you the story of their lives and of the area they live in, and that's what makes it so much fun.
I couldn't agree with you more, and, you know, toward the end of the day, one of the other things we realized was that we'd reach the age where who do you want to be has been replaced by who do you wish you had been. Now, most of all, we're very happy that we're ourselves. But other than us, the people that we are introducing you to in our book are the people we would love to have been as well.
Well, you have such an eclectic assortment of people. Everybody, you know, that you've covered, like Anna Akhmatova. Nobody's heard of her, and yet how did you get her?
Oh, Anna Akhmatova was a Russian poet who in 1912 was like a rock star. Women recited all her poetry, women dressed like her. But then World War One happened, the Russian Revolution and Civil War happened, her writings were banned, she had a terrible life. She was so banned that not only could she not publish her poetry, she was told she couldn't write it. So what she would do is she would write a poem, her friends would come over, they would learn the poem by heart, and then she would burn it in her ashtray. She outlived Stalin, and I would like to give a plug here for a woman by the name of Judith Hemsheimer, who read a poem of Akhmatova's, was so taken that she spent 3 years learning Russian, and then another 7 years translating all her poetry into English. She's fantastic. We never knew she existed. We never knew that Jean-François Champollion was the person who translated all the hieroglyphs. He was the person who told the King of England what obelisk to take from Luxor and put in the center of Paris.
Oh.
We came across a person who had conquered the avenue of the volcanoes. It's an active area of about 100 miles where there's 25 volcanoes, and they were the first people to climb them all. We came across...
I'm going to have you back because there's just too much here. There's so many stories, so many wonderful, wonderful stories. So, Thomas Tarantino, I want to thank you so much. And your wife, Barbara Scott, you have put together an absolutely fabulous book. It's inspiring, and I think that everybody, this is a perfect gift book. Mother's Day is coming up, Father's Day is coming up. This is a book that you should give to somebody in your life. Get one for yourself, but give as a gift because it is full of dream-making stories and then stories that will get you up and get you wanting to see the world. So, Thomas, thank you so much.
You can find us on Amazon. You can find us on Barnes & Noble. We have our own website, www.lookingforlegends.com. Yes, we'd love you all to read it, but more than that, we would love you to live it.
Oh, what a wonderful, you're so inspiring. Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today. And if you want, you can come back, okay?
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye now. Oh, wow. It is such a beautiful book. And it's so wonderful, all the different stories that he has and his wife. And it's fantastic. Years and years of travel in one beautiful book. It's really a perfect gift book. And now I'm going to skip commercials and everything because I wanted to give Thomas a lot of time. But I also wanted to talk to my next author. And the name of her book is Flares Up. And it is shortlisted, I know, for Sunday Times Sports Book Awards 2023. And let's find out what happens. Neve McNally, are you there?
I'm here. Lovely to connect with you, Patsy.
Oh, it's great. I just have to say, I love your name. It's one of my favorite Irish names. And I'm going to just tell people, in case they look at it and they say, what is N-I-A-M-H, it is pronounced Neve, correct?
Absolutely, perfectly done. Yes, it's a Gaelic word, so M-H in Irish makes a kind of V-F sound. Well done.
Yeah, I love it. It's beautiful. And, well, this story flares up. It's a, you know, I just was speaking to somebody who had done a lot of adventures with his wife. And now you can tell us about Flares Up and about, this is also an adventure.
Certainly. Well, Flares Up is called Flares Up, A Story Bigger Than the Atlantic. And the genesis of it was because my husband and I, we've been living on a sailboat for 6 years down in the Caribbean. And we happened to be in Antigua one day in February of 2020, sitting in the cockpit, having a late lunch, when somebody passed by and said, "They're coming." And we said, "Who's coming?" And they said, "The rowers, they're about to come ashore." And the day before, we had seen in Antigua one of these very old wooden rowboats that was part of the Woodvale Challenge years and years ago, where people built the boat and then rowed it across the Atlantic. So we were super excited, thinking, oh my goodness, we'll actually get to see somebody. Now, we had been on the boat, like I said, almost 6 years at that point, and we had done some horrific passages out in the middle of the Atlantic for a 10-day splash coming from the Bahamas down to Puerto Rico. And it wasn't exactly a passage I was looking forward to doing ever again. So for me, the idea that these guys would have got in a 20-foot wooden rowboat and rowed it 3,000 nautical miles from the Canary Islands to Antigua was just, like, mind-blowing. So what we decided to do was we jumped into our dinghy. This race, which is at that time was known as the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge, was to row from the Canary Islands, La Gomera, and arrive in Nelson's Dockyard in Antigua. But the finish line is when you cross through the channel markers, the red and green buoy markers. And that was slightly out of our view from where our boat was docked. So we jumped in the dinghy, we motored out and brought my camera. And I was turning around to Gary, and Gary was saying, "Can you see them? Can you see them?" And I said, "No, not yet, not yet." And then I was like, "Wait, I can see a dot." And then it disappeared. And I realized that little dot was them. And as they rowed up and down the swells, they were getting closer. I started taking picture after picture after picture. And then when they passed through the red and green finish line, the marker buoys, the cannon went off. Everybody on every boat in the whole area started honking and blowing their whistles. And it was just a cacophony of sound. And to mark their moment of triumph, what they do is they then light their handheld flares that they've had with them on the boat the whole way over in case of emergencies. And so they lit them and they stood up, and there was a media boat circling them in one direction, a race official boat circling them in the opposite direction. And when they passed each other and suddenly there was this gap, I was clicking away with the camera and almost like a sports photographer. And all of a sudden I said, "Oh my goodness, we've just got the shot." And I started crying. It was like watching somebody on an Olympic podium, you know, thinking of all the years of dedication it took them to actually stand up there and get a gold medal. And I was fascinated. So Gary was hooping and hollering. The whole harbor was erupting. And so we decided then to rush back ashore so that we were there when they actually climbed ashore. And when they did, they were met by the race officials and they were announced their time at sea was 70 days, 9 hours, and 11 minutes. So when they stood up and tried to get onto the dock, they were obviously like wobbling and it was like they were marine lagged as opposed to jet lagged. And I kept taking photograph after photograph. And it was so interesting to me why I couldn't understand why I was so connected to them. After the ceremony was over and the crowd kind of dissipated, the hotel brought out their first meal, which was, I believe, hamburgers, if I'm not mistaken. And suddenly they were just sitting there, the two of them, out in the grass area, nobody around. So Gary and myself went over and we started talking to them. And Gary showed them my photograph. And Paul, the main guy in the boat, turned around and said to me, he said, "You know what? That picture sums up not just the 70 days we spent at sea, but the 4 years of struggle it took us to overcome all the problems we had, all the struggles to actually get even to the starting line. So he was very taken by it. And we thought, you know what? Why don't you guys come over to our boat tomorrow night and we'll cook you your first home-cooked meal and you can tell us all about it.
Wow. Your life is an adventure. And these guys, I mean, it's like, first of all, the book is so well written. You just want to keep reading because there's a little mystery, as you said, like, who's going to be waiting for them when they get there? But imagining 70 days, I can't imagine spending 70 days in one place any time, but in a little, what possessed them? I mean, did they look at a map? Did they really understand how many miles it was?
What possessed them is a good question. It's one of the questions we actually ask in the book. So earlier, obviously 4 or 5 years earlier, Paul, who was a firefighter, he's 55 years of age. He suffers a brain hemorrhage. Actually, he was 52 when that happened. And he survived. And he took a long time to recover. And what he decided was, you know, I've got a second chance at life. I need to do something big. I need to prove all the naysayers in my life wrong, that, you know, I could amount to something. Because as a child, he had suffered from dyslexia. And so, you know, it wasn't that well understood at that time. And, you know, people thought he was just, like, stupid and unintelligent, etc. So he had to overcome a lot of challenges like that, even to pass his exams, written exams for the firefighter brigade. So that was his motivation. And then he teamed up with a man called Phil Pugh, who at the time of the race was 65. And he had always decided to do physical challenges to keep himself fit and healthy because he had a son who was born with cerebral palsy. And at about 2 months of age, this boy was not doing well, and they thought he wouldn't last the night. And Phil made a bargain with God. He said, please let my son live. If you do, I'll love him forever. I will do everything I can to take care of him, his goals, his dreams, everything. And so he kept himself physically fit so he could always lift him and bring him places. And he brings him on the Great North Run in England and does a lot of different projects with them. So that was his motivation. But guess what? Neither Paul nor Phil had actually rode before, so they had to learn from scratch. I know, it's just like inconceivable.
They never rode before. You know, I was rowing a boat from a very young age. I think I was 5 years old. I was already rowing a boat because I lived on Lake Superior. So, but for somebody, a grown up, just to say, oh, I'm going to get in that boat. I'm going to start rowing across.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's such a challenge to lay down. And, you know, it's interesting because when they came on the boat, we started talking and we started delving more into their story. And they found out I was a writer and we discussed the idea of my writing the story. And I said, you know what? In and of itself, rowing across the Atlantic, yes, it's amazing. Yes, it's a fantastic story. But really, for me, I think what people and readers would like to know is, why did you do it? How did it affect your families? And, you know, in a couple of months when you've had time to reflect on the experience, how did it change you as human being? I said, that's the story. And they both agreed, and we had a lovely evening and kind of dug deep a little bit. And I said, let's do this. Let's meet for coffee tomorrow morning and have everybody sleep on it. And we talked it through the next morning. And we said, like, okay, let's go for this. And I said, obviously, we want to talk with your wives and your families as well to try and get their opinion and sort of feedback on the whole experience. So they flew back to England. And Gary and I were on our way down to Bonaire for hurricane season. We're going to get below the hurricane belt. And guess what happened next? The pandemic. And everything shut down. And what was interesting about that is the two lads had decided that they were raising money for charities at the same time as they were doing the row. And their plan was to go back to England and do like a tour with speaking engagements and telling everybody about it. And of course, that all shut down. But for the fact that we ended up writing a book about them, their story might have died with it. Do you know what I mean? With the pandemic.
Yeah.
But we worked together for 2 years, about a year and a half altogether, you know, with phone calls and Zoom meetings, et cetera, for me to try and dig deep into their emotional and psychological and spiritual reasons for doing it. And then I decided, okay, well, it's a true adventure story, but I'd like to write it to read like a novel, so it'll be an easy read for everybody.
It does. Your writing is so, it is so terrific. It is just so good. And I, you know, it reads like a novel. It is so exciting. And it is, you really want to not put that book down. You just want to know more. And I was so thrilled when I saw that you have a foreword by Jeremy Irons. And of course, you can tell a little bit why you have that, because your father, of course, is a was a very, very famous Irish actor. As I said, I love your name because I love Ireland. I love when, you know, people would always, when I'd talk about, you know, living in England, I'd say, you know, I used to travel, and they'd say, oh, well, you went to Paris, you know, and the accent is just so nice, it's so sexy, and so, and I say, oh, no. That sexy accent is an Irish man. I can listen to an Irish guy all day long. And so, and as a matter of fact, you know, now the very best programs on, you know, streaming, nobody understands that the best series are Irish. They do such fantastic streaming series because the actors, your actors are all so good.
Thank you. Yes, Ireland has produced an amazing amount of talent, both on stage, on screen, in the writing world as well. I started out because my dad, as you said, Ray McAnally, and my mother, Ronnie Masterson, were both actors. So I grew up in an acting household. And in fact, that was my very first job. And then I got into TV directing myself. But it is true that kind of gave me an anything is possible mindset, and you know, to challenge yourself to do some of these things. And what resonated mostly for me with this story of Flares Up is that it's not really about rowing an ocean, because we're not all going to do that. And guess what? I'm certainly not going to do it. And we're not all going to climb Mount Everest. But for me, the message of the book for everybody else is it's a story about achieving goals you set yourself, no matter how big or how small they are, and to learn how to push past obstacles that you might face and really go out there and live the greatest life you can live. And interestingly enough, the name of the boat was Dee Dee, which was Dream It, Do It. And for me, that's the resonance in it. And one of the reasons that Jeremy Irons wrote the foreword for it was because I had met him and Liam Neeson and Robert De Niro and the crew on The Mission, which is a movie that was filmed in South America back in 1985, or released in 1986, and had kept in touch. And Jeremy Irons himself is a great sailor. So, and he'd also read my memoir, which is actually coming out in September. And he agreed to write the foreword. And what's really lovely about it is he's coming at it from a point of view of understanding what the ocean's about. And even he, who came to the launch of it in Dublin, Ireland, was like, I throw my hat down to you guys. You guys did it on a shoestring as well. You didn't have all the financial backing. And you really went out there and you did it and kind of showed us what can be done.
Well, they're amazing. The guys are amazing. Paul and Phil are amazing. And I love Jeremy Irons' foreword. And as you mentioned, he understands the sea, so he understands. I mean, it's every time I think of it, 70 days. I couldn't sit in my room for 70 days. Do they understand that the waves go up and down and up and down? I mean, the waves.
Absolutely. Yeah, they had like 30-foot waves and stuff like that, you know?
I mean, I don't know how they survived it. It's a miracle. It is a miracle. And I don't know if one of the reasons Jeremy Irons gave you the board, have you optioned it already? Is it going to be a film?
Well, do you know what? It's something that we're exploring. I would certainly love to bring this to the screen, whether like streaming
service.
I think it's really worth it. Yeah.
The whole story with you, you know, and sort of get it all together. It will be such a wonderful film. I will, of course, you might have to take seasick pills to watch them go up and down.
Well, one of the things that if anybody, I mean, Jeremy Irons is a beautiful actor, as you know. So for anybody who loves listening to his voice, he's got the most amazing voice. He actually narrates the foreword that he wrote in the audiobook, and then I narrate the rest of it. So it's amazing to listen to him. He's pretty super.
I have not listened to it, but I now. Not that I wouldn't love your voice, but I love his voice, of course. So I just can see that the with your talent as a writer and your knowledge of filmmaking, and you have all these connections to great filmmakers. I think some other of your family members are actors, right? You have
I've got a whole family, yes, a whole boat lot of us. My brother Connor McAnally is a TV producer and does a lot of music television programs. And my brother Angus, on-air talent, and also he's a magician, musician, a very all-rounded entertainer.
We've got a family here. We've got a marvelous family. And, of course, you're coming out with your own book. As you said, your book is coming out in September, and I you're already booked, I think, to be on my program, and it's called Following Sunshine, a voyage around mind, around the world, and around the heart. And so I'm looking forward to that. I think it's so wonderful. Really, you have to get the family together, for goodness sakes. Find somebody to pick this up. It's going to be, I get such a kick out of it, the idea, and I think that, you know, all of you and the guys, they're all so interesting. This is going to be one of those films that people really, it's going to be, I hope, you know, you've won some awards for Flares Up, beautifully written, and it's an exciting book, it's a real life thriller. You've done a wonderful job. So when you're ready to announce the streaming contract that you're going to get, the option for this, you have to come on the program and tell me about it, okay? And tell my listeners.
I will indeed. And if anybody wants to keep up on it, my website is called thewriteronthewater.com. And I'll be announcing all my new books and stuff coming up there as well.
Okay, well, really, it is so wonderful. Everybody, you can get this. Go to Neve's website. Follow her, because we're going to, as I said, we're going to have her back here in September to talk about Following Sunshine, which is a great title for a book, Following Sunshine, because that's what we should do in life. We should follow the sunshine. And I think you are just, it's so exciting. As I was reading it, and in the back of my mind, I knew, you know, you were an actor. So, well, I don't know if you have ever acted yourself, but I'm sure your family's full of it.
I did start out there.
I was thinking, yeah, I'm sure that somewhere along the line, because you're writing this in a way, I mean, this will, the screenplay is like half written already. So you're ready for it.
Thank you so much. That's very sweet of you.
Well, you're a visual writer, and people, be ready to go to sea for 70 days. Also, you know,
it's one thing you were asking. We're talking about like people, the story behind books and getting into writing. One of the reasons I run writers workshops as well is because I believe everybody has a story to tell, and they can tell it uniquely, their story. And interesting for me, people ask me, well, how did you know, when did you become a writer? And I said, well, it was interesting. In all my travels I used to do, I never just sent postcards. I would write letters about, you know, where I'm at. And the response I used to get was, I feel like I'm right there. I can see it. I can feel it. I can taste it. And so you're correct. For me, I write from a visual perspective. And maybe that is my background in television training originally. I see the image and I actually write in my head, which helps me avoid the blank page. So I go out on my bike ride in the morning and I start writing a sentence or two. So when I come in, I sit down at the typewriter or the laptop and, you know, the first couple of lines are already out, which is a great start.
Well, I'm glad you said that you write it in your head, because when I get a book and when I'm like 3, 4, 5 pages in and I start seeing it in my head and I forget almost that I'm reading, because it's so visual. When an author can do that, just sort of suck you in there. I mean, I know I'm reading. There were times when I'm like, I sort of stopped myself. I said, I'm reading this. I'm not really on that boat. I'm not really going to get seasick, but I felt like it. So beautiful writing, beautiful, absolutely amazing. So everybody, get this book. It's by Niamh McAnally. I love that name. And it's called Flares Up. It's a wonderful book, really wonderful. And thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are a joy. Your life has lived a lot of joy. And so we're looking to having you back and talking about Following Sunshine. So thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Wow. Oh, I love this book. I love this book. Oh, wow. Oh, I needed an adventure like that. I can tell you. Okay, everyone. Just reminding you, we now have Joy on Paper live also, and you can see that on Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening or whatever. We're posting a lot of videos there, so check out Joy on Paper Live on the YouTube. That's our YouTube channel, and that's going to be lots of fun. And you know what? I didn't invite her to be on. I will. The minute I get off the phone, I'm going to. The minute I'm getting off the radio, I'm going to phone her and invite her to be on that program too, because she's just. Oh, it's a wonderful book. I needed that adventure. You know, if you want an adventure that takes you out someplace, that's the one. Anyway, everybody, remember, you know, I just am so happy with all the things I've gotten from the 9th anniversary and all your messages. So I want to thank you for that. I want to just tell you again that, if, you know, as both of these authors today followed their dreams, they had big dreams, they followed them. And if you want to write a book, well, you know, you should. And I can help you. And again, on Joy on Paper Live, I'm going to be giving you some really, really great information about how you can start writing your book and make your dreams come true. And meanwhile, you know, it's beautiful. It's springtime. Get out there. If you don't have a hammock, get yourself a hammock and read a book between the trees and just relax. This weekend, it's going to be a lovely, lovely weekend. And well, except for you people who have snow, but I always warn you, you know, at the end of March, you can have a blizzard, so you never know. But say something nice to somebody, say something. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. I salute you, Big Ed. Everybody, bye bye, take care.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
Listen.
It's time for the Thursday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. Prior Smith speaking from Toronto. Thanks for joining us. Well, a good chunk of eastern Canada is into several months with gusty winds, a month's worth of rain, and in some areas, wet snow. It's sloppy today and then some. This mess will continue through tomorrow, but then nice spring weather is in the forecast starting on the weekend. By early next week, this will be but a bad memory. with sunny skies and midday highs here in southern Ontario in the low to mid-60s Fahrenheit. The rain and wet snow of yesterday, today, and tomorrow will certainly get the gardens growing, and the moisture is welcome indeed. Across the West, they could use some of this moisture in a big way, given the drought conditions over the past couple of years. In the news, over the past week, Prime Minister Trudeau has been making an announcement du jour, a campaign-style promise or pledge of billions for this and billions for that, a day-by-day preview of what's to be announced in the upcoming federal budget. The announcements have been long on sincerity and, for the most part, short on specifics. In some cases, they step into areas of provincial jurisdiction. The Prime Minister was at it again yesterday, this time in Toronto, announcing a $15 billion loan program to stimulate rental apartment construction. The announcement on Tuesday was a $6 billion infrastructure fund to generate housing development all across the country. The announcement came with a bunch of strings attached. Well, it took the provinces a matter of minutes to say thanks but no thanks. With that, Federal Housing Minister Sean Fraser said, okay, Ottawa's prepared to go around the provinces that don't agree with the federal funding conditions. As the Prime Minister tries to turn attention away from the carbon tax increase this week, more announcements of this nature are expected in days ahead, in advance of the budget day, April 16th. And now this message. For many Canadian vacationers in Florida, I hate to say it, but this is it. The final weekend of the season in the sunny south. Time to pack up the car in days ahead for the long drive home. The folks at your neighborhood Publix would like to take a moment to say thanks for your patronage over the past few months, and they look forward to welcoming you and your friends and neighbors back to Florida in the fall or next winter. A reminder, as you clear out the kitchen cupboard, count on the folks at Publix to help out with end-of-season vacation meals, be it prepared dinners including fresh salads in the deli, fresh baked breads and dessert treats in the bakery, or fresh citrus in the produce department. For quick, tasty, and nutritious meals, minus all the work, depend on Publix, where shopping is a pleasure. In other news, here in Canada, we probably won't have a federal election for another year and a half. A lot can happen between now and then, so polls on federal political party popularity can come and go. It's best to take them with a grain of salt. For months, the federal Tories have held a commanding lead over the Liberals, at times in the range of 20 points. The latest poll shows the lead shrinking to 12, with the Tories supposedly at 38%, the Liberals at 26. The federal New Democrats, who've been propping up the Liberals since the last election, are down 3 to 18. The Tories are said to be still struggling in Quebec, where the Bloc is said to be gaining strength at the expense of the Liberals. Who do Canadians prefer as Prime Minister? Pierre Poilievre leads Justin Trudeau by about 13 points. The NDP's Jagmeet Singh's support has dipped 3 in the past month. Continuing a 70-year broadcast tradition, this is Canada Calling.
Hi, this is Eric from the Knife and Fork Radio Show. Tune in every Thursday morning between 9 and 10 a.m. where we talk about everything restaurant, food, and drink related. The phone lines will be open, and we will love to take your call-ins and hear about all of your experiences. Once again, it's a Knife and Fork Radio Show every Thursday between 9 and 10 a.m. right here on the Tantalk Radio Network.
And now Canada Calling continues. So what's doing in the real estate market? Numbers from the month of March tell us the market is still tight. In Vancouver, home sales down 5% year over year. The Toronto region, the biggest market in the country, sales down 4.5%. Sales in the condo market here, down 13%. Despite the fact fewer homes were sold, prices were actually up a fraction. Bottom line, the market, it seems, won't heat up until interest rates come down. At the Toronto Stock Exchange, the index up 37, 22,112, and the buck 73.9 U.S. Car theft in Canada has been an ever-increasing problem for the past 5 years. For example, in Montreal alone, 9,000 vehicles were stolen in 22. Last year, the number was 11,000. Vehicles are stolen, many wind up in shipping containers in the port of Montreal, and then they wind up in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, or Eastern Europe. In the latest update yesterday, a task force of border officials, Ontario and Quebec police, say they've recovered 598 vehicles, 75% of them in containers in the port of Montreal, and many of them are from southern Ontario. The total value, $34.5 million. And finally, what's in a name? Momentum seems to be growing to rename the 400 highway that links Toronto with Muskoka in northern Ontario after Gordon Lightfoot, who was born and raised in Orillia. An online petition started by friends and former school classmates has already gathered about 15,000 signatures. If there is to be a renaming of the highway, hopefully it's handled in a vastly better fashion than the renaming of Toronto's Yonge and Dundas Square. That new name is something virtually no one wants or understands and has no connection at all to anything in the city. This is Canada Calling, and online at canadacalling.com. Back tomorrow for the final day of Canada Calling's 70th broadcast season. This is Pryor Smith speaking from Toronto.